This is what I want to know, Laura. What stories did you consider for this week but not decide to do?
There was one on organ donations are up because of the opioid crisis.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So that's a silver lining, I guess.
Is it like people who die of an overdose are more likely to be able to donate somehow?
They're... more people dying with good organs.
Oh, like because they're dying young.
Yep.
That's dark.
Yep. So that's why we
it's really, really dark.
That's why we didn't go there, Robin. Thanks
so
for
what
asking.
What you're saying is you didn't want to discuss that on the podcast, and here we are.
Here we are. Are you ready for first article?
Let's jump right in.
This article comes from Reuters, which is pasta as a part of a healthy diet, not tied to weight gain.
What?
Yeah.
As opposed to what?
That it's pasta is not a make or break thing.
Oh.
That's what it's saying. To lose weight or just avoid gaining it, pasta is not the most one of the harmful carbs that needs to be sacrificed. So, like, although it's made of refined grains, it's low in glycemic index, and the data was analyzed from 32 previous trials comparing eating pasta as part of a diet based on other low glycemic foods versus eating high glycemic diet without pasta. And researchers found that people lost more weight on the low glycemic diet with pasta, and that pasta itself does not cause weight gain or increase in body fat. So it kind of goes against what, you know, we would assume.
Conventional wisdom is that pasta isn't so good for you, right? It's like bread, pasta, white potatoes. Carbs are really getting a bad rap these days.
Yeah. So it goes... they wanted to answer the test question, does pasta have an adverse effect as suggested by the headlines, blog posts, and some of the expert opinions that you can find on both social and conventional media?
Hmm.
So I hadn't heard it called conventional media, and that was my biggest takeaway. I went, oh, okay.
Learning what conventional media is, huh?
Yeah. So it included over 2,448 participants who were overweight or obese, and they followed them for at least 12 weeks, and in some cases, 24, and they tracked the weight, and many of the trials assessed the body fat as reflected by waist circumference, waist-hip ratio, and body mass index.
Okay. I mean, I wish they would have tracked body fat percentage using an accurate measurement, because I think the most accurate way of doing it is to actually, like, they like submerge you in water or something, and there's like a caliper test, which is less accurate. I think the waist hip ratio is okay, and I suppose waist circumference over a short period of time could work. BMI isn't a great measure of like what your percentage of body fat is. Because you can be, like, skinny fat and just be, like, someone who stores a lot of fat in between your organs. So, be it known. Like, for example, right now, I might be slightly, quote-unquote, fatter than I was before. Meaning, like, fattier, right? As opposed to actually weighing more. Like, I, after a few months of not exercising, have lost muscle and gained fat. I also have eaten some pasta, so that's good to know. I had no idea that pasta was low glycemic index food. Like, none. Okay, Laura, listen to this. Are you ready for some solid science on this matter? Okay, So there is a website, glycemicindex.com, and they say pasta has a low glycemic index because of the physical entrapment of ungelatinized starch granules in a sponge-like network of protein, gluten, parentheses, molecules in the pasta dough. Pasta is unique in this regard. As a result, pastas of any shape and size have a fairly low GI, 30 to 60, which includes Asian noodles, udon, rice, vermicelli, etc. But if you overcook the pasta, it boosts the glycemic index. So something about it being al dente is better.
You're al dente. I don't know what that means. So,
hey, time out for a second. I think my neighbor is like jumping up and down or something upstairs, and I'm just gonna wait for her or him to stop before we keep going because it's making some noise on the thing. Hey. This is really awkward.
It'd be more awkward if we were FaceTiming. Sorry, future Anthony. Past Anthony doesn't give a fuck.
They were doing this earlier and I just assumed it was
Thumbing Jacks.
Yeah. I kind of want to be like, hey, don't do that, but I feel like you can't. It's just like, come on, you're on the second floor. You know, like, you can't do jumping jacks. Like, go on your patio outside. Okay, we're done.
What does al dente mean?
Al dente means it's like springy, kind of firm. I don't know what it literally means. I'll ask Google.
So
it means to the tooth. Oh, like dental, dente. Firm to the bite. And so that helps preserve its low glycemic index status.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay, so low glycemic index foods, oatmeal, pasta, sweet potato, like plant types of things, fruit, medium, like brown rice, quick oats, high, white bread, cornflakes, melons, pretzels, pineapple, white potatoes. So we were right about white bread and white potatoes, but we were wrong about pasta.
Yeah.
I wonder what about gluten-free pasta, though?
Completely different thing.
Oh, no.
When was the last time you had gluten-free pasta?
I think about 5 days ago.
Okay.
I eat a lot of it. Or I eat a decent amount of it, I guess. Or it's kind of like a treat for me. Although I recently learned that non-gluten-free people can certainly taste the difference. Because I made lunch for some friends. We were doing like a little cabin getaway thing. And everyone was taking turns cooking. And I made this like turkey bolognese. Well, that's not how you pronounce it, but oh well. I made this turkey pasta dish, and I used a pasta that has quinoa in it, and I forgot that when I make gluten-free pasta for non-gluten-free people, I usually use like pastas that are a rice-corn blend because it's the quinoa pasta has more of a taste. And so I also had I just forgot because to me, I can't remember anymore what pasta tastes like, so they don't really taste that different. But so I asked people if they could notice, and they were like, there's kind of a, and I was like, oh, sorry, guys. So note to self, no more pasta for the non-gluten-free folks. Because I think for them, it's just like sad pasta then, even though for me, it feels normal.
Yeah, I guess you get used to anything then.
I'm not about to go outside and eat dog poop, all right?
No, but if you ate a lot of dog poop, eventually it would stop being weird.
I'd be like, where's the Alfredo sauce? Okay, you know what I want to know about this story that's not in here? Is, like, did they all eat the exact same diet, or are they self-reporting their diet and they just told some people to eat 3 servings of pasta a week and some people not to? It's like, how do they control for other factors?
It was a compilation of 32 other studies, Robin.
Oh. Well, then I feel like, how do you know it was definitely not?
Because they compiled the data for 32 and compared.
I clicked through the link, Laura, and I'm going to tell you there's a bunch of numbers. And there's a multicolored chart. I'm going to have to believe them about this.
They use math, I'm convinced.
You can get the whole study. See, I feel like this was well done. It's in the BMJ, which is reputable. Yeah. I think there are, like, statistical ways of, like, controlling for certain variables. I wish I had, like, a more solid handle on stats, you know? Like, I took a course in grad school, and I know a little bit, but I really, there's so much you could know, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's like a whole thing.
95% confidence interval. So they said that their findings were, like, they graded them as moderate, meaning they're pretty sure. Pretty sure, not completely sure.
Yeah, I don't think it's saying, like, it's super duper healthy for you, but it is saying, like, that it's not something that has been, as much as it's been vilified in, like, blog posts and reporting, it's not as bad as everyone gives it credit to be.
Yeah, and that's really good to know, you know, because I feel like I had no idea, and I feel like pasta specifically is vilified.
Yeah, quite for frequently.
Sure. All right, what's our next story?
So our next news story comes from Kaiser Health News, and it's Nightmare Bacteria Stalks U.S. Hospitals. Bum, bum,
bum. So we had a very enthusiastic headline writer. I feel like this is the type of headline that would get a lot of clicks.
Yes. So the Center for Disease Control and Prevention detected more than 220 cases last year of a rare breed of nightmare bacteria that are virtually untreatable and capable of spreading genes that make them impervious to most antibiotics.
Okay.
The CDC has warned of the dangers of antibiotic-resistant bacteria for years. The new report helps illustrate the scope of the problem. So
who actually said the phrase nightmare bacteria? I'm seeing it in all sorts of headlines.
That's what it's called. Like, the nightmare bacteria is the one that is impervious to all things. So, 2 million Americans are sickened by antibiotic-resistant bacteria each year, with 23,000 die.
But they're saying, like, they have 220 cases of a bacteria that they have termed nightmare bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought initially that we were saying, you know, this is, like, theoretical, like, a night. So that they're saying, I'm surprised the CDC would use that language to describe it.
Well, they're trying to make people aware. In a 2016 report commissioned by the British government and the Wellcome Trust called for investing in $40 billion over the next decade to fighting the problem, about 700,000 people around the world die to antibiotic resistance each year. Without immediate action, annual deaths could rise to 10 million by 2050. According to the report.
Mm-hmm.
Bacteria naturally evolves to resist drugs used against them. And one of the problems is that there's an overprescribing of antibiotics when they're not needed. And that is one way that they're trying to reduce the resistance, is by prescribing them less. And another way is vaccines can help fight antibiotic resistance by preventing people from ever becoming sick and needing antibiotics.
I mean, that's not exactly, 'cause, like, aren't vaccines preventing against viral illnesses Yes. Antibiotics are bacterial illnesses, so...
Yes, but if you go into the hospital where these antibacterial bugs are being spread from, are they're in the hospital and they're being spread from patient to doctor to other sick patient. Okay. So,
so we're saying just by getting sick.
If we can prevent us from going into the place where this is happening, then that can also help reduce the things.
Yeah. Not to mention that still significant numbers of people with viral illnesses are given antibiotics. So in a way, you could argue that vaccines do prevent antibiotic prescription just by preventing that type of misprescribing.
Yeah.
Hey.
Another way too.
I'm just did the CDC itself nightmare bacteria? Because I feel like the CDC is kind of very, like, they're not going to want to incite some sort of, like, a panic, except for apparently when they do. Maybe the CDC just got fed up with all of us and was like, listen, seriously, stop it with the Z-Packs and everything.
Yeah. So these types of things are particularly deadly to the elderly and also the chronically ill.
All right. I looked on the CDC's website, and they actually do use the phrase nightmare bacteria. As early as, like, 2012, they're talking about, like, advanced genetic sequencing and bioinformatic capabilities that they use in, like, infectious disease outbreak responses. And yeah, they've got like a story they released that starts the diagnosis of a drug resistant nightmare bacteria in two Colorado patients spurred hospital and state officials to join forces with CDC to investigate. And the bacteria, which has a name, is Carpa benema resistant Enterobacteriaceae, or CRE, have become resistant to all or nearly all of the antibiotics we have today. So I wonder if that is the same thing, that the same illness they're talking about now. Because I'm going to go out on a limb and say the CDC is not going to call two different things.
Probably not.
Nightmare bacteria. Right.
So from 2012, there were two cases. And then last year, 5 years later, there were 220.
Which is so scary.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's a nightmare.
Good branding, CDC.
Yeah.
We're freaked out. Oh, yeah. So this, the CDC's actually been reporting on this every year since 2012. We just didn't, whoa, you should see this graph. In 2001, it was only in North Carolina. Sorry, North Carolina. And in 2013, it was in all but like a handful of states. So if you're in Maine, Idaho, or Alaska, also Vermont, you were safe in 2013. But... yeah. Wow. So the CDC is like, we've been telling you, stop doing it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I feel like we are more likely to die than ever before.
Checks
that
out.
Kind of freaks me out. Yeah.
You're welcome.
You should see my face over here. I'm feeling... okay, antibiotic resistance is one of the things that I'm actually kind of nervous about in real life. Like, it's something that when I think about it, I'm like, ugh. And I don't think most people really think about it that way, but I just feel like we're not great as a society at dealing with these things and containing them in a smart way. You know, like, we can tell people, hey, if you have these symptoms, da, 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 like, don't travel, but, like, just being... like Americans and workaholics, we tend to have some behaviors that I think might be associated with a rather rapid spread. Although we have a sophisticated system, government organization, supposedly for dealing with that. So six of one, half dozen of the other. Laura?
Yes?
This is a question for you. Are we all going to die?
Yes. The human life is fatal.
Mm. True. All right. Then no need to worry about it. Next story.
Next story comes from NBC News, which is club drug spray ketamine can ketamine can stop suicidal thoughts, study finds. So it's a club drug that can help people with dangerously suicidal, rapidly treating their depression and wish to die. It was given to people who were reporting suicidal thoughts and considering acting upon it, who went to the ER for assistance. And they found that within...
Sorry. The way you phrased that made it... Like, they wanted to commit suicide, so they went to the ER for help. You know, they're like, listen, this knife is just not sharp enough.
Yeah, I guess that was kind of funny. So, the nasal spray was showing to have benefits within 4 hours of use. Mm. And it's tested on 68 patients. They were an immediate risk, and they were also given counseling and antidepressants. And half were given nasal spray, and the other half were given placebo. Within 34 hours, 34% of the patients had lost their immediate thoughts of suicide, saying they enjoy life or take it as it comes, with 23% on placebo. 55% of those who got the placebo said they were probably better off dead, compared to 26%. And then they got the spray twice a week for 4 weeks, plus standard of treatment. After 25 days, 77% said that they enjoy life or take it as it comes, versus 58% of those on the placebo. And the four-week treatment was deliberate, because typically that's a standard amount of time that it takes an antidepressant to kick in.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons it can be so tricky to treat depression, is because you give someone a drug and then you're supposed to spend a month waiting to see if it works. Well, if it doesn't work, that's just another month. And what if it takes 4 or 5 medications, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, I think this is hugely interesting. And I actually have had a couple conversations with people about ketamine recently, believe it or not.
Like you do.
As one does. Well, no, so I know about ketamine because I'm from a family of veterinarians, and ketamine is commonly used, I think, as like a painkiller in cats. And my understanding from like talking to my dad is that ketamine was initially kind of trialed and was useful in burn patients for like the excruciating pain of dressing changes, but was having some lingering hallucinogenic effects, or like, I think like they would have some kind of weird mental experience on the drug, and then like later they would have flashbacks to it even when they weren't taking it anymore. So it what was thought at the time was that, you know, this is not really a suitable drug for people who need pain relief over time. But I also met a wilderness paramedic recently here in Oregon who, when we spoke, had just used ketamine on a mountain biker who had an accident and broke a bunch of ribs and had to be like carried off of the mountain. So say a lot of like jiggling up and down. And apparently with the ketamine, the person was very, very comfortable. So, because it kind of, apparently it does change your mental space. Like you kind of, I guess, get like a twilight feeling, or kind of like I'm floating, but you don't really think you've got your feet on the ground. So the idea of like relieving temporary discomfort with it is supposedly like coming back into favor again. Do I get points for having everyday conversations about ketamine? Because I feel like here we are.
Absolutely. I will be mailing your gold star to you here momentarily.
Thank you.
There were side effects that included bad taste in the mouth, nausea, and an unpleasant feeling of disassociation. So,
yeah,
in some cases, it might be needed.
Yeah, so I think, like, in the case of the person with the cracked ribs, the disassociation was wanted, right? Like, that was a desired side effect.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, the purpose of the study was, I think, just to see if it works. The FDA has not approved it for this use. It has not been tried out in a larger scale in anything. But considering how there is a critical need to assist people who are severely depressed, this may be a way. So, but it's also...
Yeah. Which is a miracle, which would seem almost like a miracle if you could help someone not, like, who someone with, like, active suicidal ideation, if you could help them within hours. I think that that is somewhat unusual. Usually we can't do that, right?
Absolutely. However, ketamine is also a drug that is can be... Abused,
yes.
And so they were discussing how can we prevent people from abusing it, and one of them would be distributing through a special process that would have a single dose spray, so you would have to be prescribed it, and so continuously get back to get it in order to help.
There,
yeah. To prevent abuse, which is good because they're thinking about these things rather than waiting until it's an issue, and then we'll come back and think about that.
They're thinking about how to prevent it. And what's interesting that I just Googled while we were chatting is that ketamine is not actually a narcotic, which I think I had kind of thought that it was. So narcotics, I think, are Schedule 2 medications, and ketamine is a Schedule 3 medication. So I think Schedule 1 is, like, illegal drugs for the most part. Schedule 2 tends to be more narcotic-y things. So they're kind of, like, classifying drugs by how dangerous they are. Although I want to say, like,
not true. Marijuana is the number one.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, right, how dangerous they are.
Cocaine and heroin. Same level of danger.
right. So the DEA has put some value statements on some of the medications that aren't necessarily based on science. Of course, we can't do a lot of research on marijuana because it's not legal in so many places, right? And because so much research is federally funded. So hilariously, sometimes they'll say, like, well, there's no evidence that suggests that marijuana is useful or da-da-da-da. But, of course, no one... You know, they're also stopping the research on it. So
that's a little American-centric because it is legal in other places, and they also have research there too.
Okay, that's fair.
Somebody should be quoting some Amsterdam researchers or something.
Yeah, and I do think we tend to be very like our medical system tends to approve drugs after a more lengthy process, tends to, you know, like, we're kind of on our own little island, you know, like, you could get, like, 10 countries in the European Union who will all say a drug is safe, and then, like, our government agencies are like, whoa. So, yeah, we have a different process. And that's affected IUD manufacturers as well. I mean, I think part of that is, like, supply and demand, but I know in Europe there's, like, dozens of types, and here in the U.S. right now... I don't know how many. There's at least 4, but there's certainly not 20, right? So it's this whole kind of, like, interesting thing. But anyway, the takeaway here is that I need to think more about other countries and that ketamine is Schedule 3. So, yeah.
So, yeah, it could possibly have some positive benefits, but it's important to take into consideration negative side effects as well.
Indeed. So Tylenol, codeine, also Schedule 3, anabolic steroids, and testosterone. Did not know that. And interestingly, some drugs that I would have considered somewhat addictive are Schedule 4. I guess Schedule 4 is supposed to be low potential for abuse. And Xanax, Valium, Ativan, Ambien, Tramadol, Darvocet, Soma, I mean, I feel like Valium and Xanax. I've heard some stuff. And then schedules 4 and 5 are getting into doses. Because then they're saying it's less than so many milligrams of codeine per so many milliliters, like in cough syrups and stuff. So, you know, I never knew that about the scheduling. I just really knew schedules 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, and I'm glad, as you pointed out, that they're taking action to prevent this from becoming something that's sold on the street. Even though that seems almost inevitable, right?
Probably, but they can do things to prevent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Special K is one of its street names. Do you want to hear the other street names?
Yes.
K. K2. Vitamin K. Super K. Super C. Lady K. Ket. Kit Kat. Ketoset. Ketoject. Jet. Super Acid. Green. Purple. Mauve. Super Acid's in there again. I'm assuming that's a mistake. Special LA Coke. Cat tranquilizers and cat Valium. I think those are actually veterinary references.
Seem like it, yeah.
And it is a drug related to PCP. Yeah. Good times.
Good times.
So, that's legal? Marijuana not legal? ? You fill in the blank.
Yeah. All right, you ready for our last news story?
Yeah, definitely.
So our last one comes from the National Public Radio, and it's Bill of the Month, a tale of two cat scanners, one richer, one poorer.
So this is I know where this is going.
This is the story of a man who lives in Florida who you went to a imaging center for a cat scan because he was having some abdominal pain. The cat scan was used... and they didn't find anything wrong in the images.
Hang on. My neighbor's jumping again.
What the fuck, man? Who jumps?
I don't know. I feel like if they do this every 30 minutes forever, it's going to drive me up a wall.
Maybe it's a social experiment on you.
I think they're done.
Okay. So this is a story of a man who lives in Florida who was having some abdominal pain, and he went to an imaging center for a CAT scan, and it didn't find anything wrong, and so... there was no recommended treatment. He got his... he has a high deductible health insurance policy and got a bill for $268. He paid it and moved on. 3 months later, he was still not feeling great, so he called the doctor's office. The doctor wasn't available, so the nurse practitioner was concerned that he might be suffering from appendicitis and suggested that he go to... the hospital. So he went to the hospital in Florida, and the triage nurse told him the problem wasn't his appendix, but suggested that he stick around for some additional tests, including another CAT scan, just to be safe. And it was the exact same test, and the results were once again fine. Then he got the bill. The total bill was $10,174.75, including $8,897 for the CAT scan.
So, oh my God.
So the question is why does this happen? So it was 33 times higher. And what it was is that, what their takeaway is that, like, Medicare typically dictates how much, people will charge for. And so the smaller imaging center charges $268 because that is what they get reimbursed from Medicaid for, but the hospital has what they call, you know, frequent flyers where they have people who come in and use the services but have no insurance and no ability to pay. And so they jack up the price in order for patients with insurance. Sure. Yeah. In order to help cover the cost or whatever. So
yeah.
They also said...
And to be fair, like, his... Like, they have a copy of the bill in here. So they billed him, like, almost $8,900. And then his insurance negotiated rate was about $5,500. So still ridiculous, but maybe half as ridiculous as it appears.
So Hayden was on the hook for $3,394.49. In addition... to the ER cost of $261.76. No one from the hospital or healthcare center would agree for an interview.
Shocking.
So what the takeaway was, A, he was still feeling crappy later, and so he went back to the imaging center and got an ultrasound, and it revealed that he had a sty on his insides, and it would a benign cyst, and it would likely go away on their own.
Oh my gosh, this poor guy. That's so much money.
But the takeaway is that that tests are almost always going to be more expensive at the emergency room or hospital setting.
Oh yeah.
If your doctor suggests you go to the ER, it might be worth asking whether there's an imaging center or urgent care or walk-in clinic that would suffice.
That being said, in this case, I'm guessing that for liability reasons, the nurse practitioner would have said no.
No, but the hospital said you should stick around for a CAT scan. Not appendicitis. That is when he may have been able to ask. But the other problem is they don't tell you how much this shit is going to cost until after two months later when you get the fucking bill. Like, that's the other thing, too. There's no way to know other than to know that hospitals and ERs tend to be more expensive.
Yeah. Well, sometimes now they do, like, in rare situations. We have one provider here in Portland and elsewhere, I think, as well, that, like, I went there when I was having my string of viral illnesses in the winter, and they wanted to do a bunch of tests, and I asked them, you know, what they ballpark thought it might cost, and they actually showed me an itemized list and said this is the most it would cost, and then your insurance may charge less if they have a negotiated rate with us. And I was really impressed by that, and the pricing was really fair.
And you had but you had to ask.
Yeah, that's true. I had to ask.
And if you're unconscious.
You don't know to ask, or they just do it. Also, I think that probably the places that are charging 33 times more than they should probably aren't going to be the same places that offer to show you the pricing, right? Probably. The place I went was willing to show me because that's part of their model, is they're trying to appeal to the price conscious among us or whatever. I had this CT scan... A similar thing happened to me 8 or 10 years ago. Like, I needed one, and my doctor had ordered it. And so I was going to just go to, I think it was like a, you know, like a medical arts center, like attached to the hospital or whatever, affiliated with his office. They quoted me $3,300 for the scan. I ended up going to a ProScan, which I think that's a chain. And they tend to be cheaper. And they charged me $250. So at that time, it was about, well, what, 10 or so, more than 10 times higher.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, I've interviewed hospital executives and, you know, lightly touched on this question before. And they always kind of make the references to what you said, you know, we have to staff the emergency room 24 hours, but also things like services that they're required to provide, like parking for maternity patients, that Medicare is not going to reimburse for. So in order to be licensed, they have to provide a certain, like, physical infrastructure, yet Medicare isn't going to let them tack on $5 per patient for that parking garage next to the maternity ward or whatever.
That's fair.
So then that's part of their justification is they've charged more for other stuff. But what I think we're seeing here is that, yeah, but like how much more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, because this guy, I mean, this guy could have put in part of a parking structure just with his bill alone, right?
Yeah.
You know, $10,000.
Yeah.
Dude. Yeah, also, I think if you're out there and you're listening, that a really good takeaway from this piece is the resource Healthcare Blue Book.
Yes.
They are really, I've used them. They're really reliable. They will search for pricing based on your zip code, and they'll give you a range of what a fair price would be. And I was just looking at some lab tests recently and comparing, you know, my pricing versus what my insurance company had negotiated and what I ended up paying, what they thought was fair. And yeah, they were pretty much spot on, like for the rates in my area. So I have been very impressed. And I think it might just be healthcarebluebook.com. I'm going to check and see really fast because I think this is important. Yep, healthcarebluebook.com. Use it. Love it. Thank us later.
All right, Robin, what's your current medical fascination?
Well, Laura, I'm glad you asked this question because this week there was a story we didn't talk about that I wanted to talk about. And I didn't get a chance to dig all the way into the study, but do you know those hand dryers in the bathroom where you stick your hands in and you pull them out slowly? They're like the newer ones.
The Dyson ones, yeah.
Well, I hate those hand dryers. You know why?
Why?
Because I always end up touching my hands against the thing accidentally. And then I'm like, this is not hygienic at all. Like, you end up whapping your hands against the sides a little bit, and I don't like it. I want to like it, but I don't like it. And there's always all the dirty water at the bottom. So this study found that they may not be the most hygienic option for exactly the reasons that I was thinking, because the water tends to collect, and then because they're blowing at such a high rate of speed, they may actually be like a little reservoir for like bacteria laden, like germ laden water, and then they blow it all over the bathroom. And so, yeah. It's one of those things where I kind of intuitively felt like I don't love this, and everyone loved it, and I was just like, okay, fine, you know, da 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 da. And it's as of yet unproven. They're just starting to look at it and theorize this. And probably Snopes is your best source on this. It's been reported, you know, like here's an example, Fox News. Bathroom hand dryer spraying poop on your hand, study finds. And, like, that's not exactly, I don't think that's not exactly what the study is saying. So, you know, it's one of these, like more research is needed types of deals, mm-hmm. but you know, to say immediately, like, it's spraying fecal matter all over your hands. It's just like, no, it's really not. That being said, is there a chance that I'm right and that they're actually worse? Yep. So, according to this one study.
Awesome. You're right.
Yeah, and they found that, like, it could be spraying it as far as 15 feet. Like, including onto your freshly washed hands, right?
It's fair.
So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's not like the old hand dryers were ideal either. Like, okay, what's your ideal hand drying situation? Like, you go into a restroom, you wash your hands. What are you hoping you're going to see?
My pants.
Your pants! But then your pants are wet.
So?
I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
I don't know, you go in, you sit down, because I'm a girl, and you stand up and it flushes for you. You open the door, you walk over to the, hands-free sink, use the motion-sensored soap, you use your elbow for the dryer, and you get all pristine and clean, and you walk up to that door, and you push it open with your hand.
But I don't. But I don't. I push open with my foot.
Mm-hmm.
No, if I have to grab the handle, I'm always kind of, like, sad about it. Or if there's, like, what I really like is if there's a trash can near the door, because then I can grab a towel. But really, I don't know. I mean, you can only do so well, I suppose, but... Sometimes, sadly, I kind of prefer the paper, even though I know it's really bad. But the dryers are good, too. I just feel like a lot of the time they're broken. Mm-hmm. All the stuff's broken. Like, what is with that? The towel dispensers tend to be broken. The dryers tend to be broken. These new dryers are spraying germs 15 feet in the air. I think that maybe the idea they have is good, but the execution is bad.
Maybe.
Because you do. I mean, tell me that you can use one of those without touching your hand on the sides at all.
I can, but I also don't get them dry because I don't do it slow enough.
Yeah, see? That's the other thing. Am I supposed to really stand there and, like, pull my hands out, like, 1 millimeter at a time? You know?
Yes, Robin. That's what that's how I was... Yes.
At least with the other dryer, you can, like, rub your hands a little bit and make them dry out faster.
It doesn't matter. Well, no, I know. It doesn't matter, Robin. Let me tell you exactly what's going to happen. Whether it's a paper towel or it's a dryer, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to barely focus, just a quick swipe with the paper towel or just a quick flick of the wrist underneath the hair dryer, and then I'm going to walk to the door while wiping my hands on my pants. That's what's going to happen.
I guess you wear dark colored pants.
I do. I do not care.
Well, that might be cleaner than the dryer, so good for you.
At least no warm pants have been.
So I think that's enough bad patienting for me for one day, Laura. Okay, so thanks so much, as always, for listening. Before we take off, we are going to say a special thank you to our composer, Evan Schaefer,
for our
theme song. You can listen to his music at soundcloud.com/Evan Schaefer. Please connect with us by emailing hello@thebadpatient.com. You can listen online straight from our website at thebadpatient.com. You can follow us on Twitter @thebadpatient, or you can check out the Bad Patient podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast news. Until next time, we are Bad Patient.
Malpractice makes perfect.